everybody.
Welcome to the 2018 iteration of our practice together. It's really terrific that so many are gathering to begin the year in this way, because this is such a wholesome support for living in a very troubled world, troubled human world. In this tradition, we practice settling our minds and hearts, resting the mind, resting the thinking mind, and opening awareness, and becoming more and more able to access pure awareness. And the wisdom that flows from being able to be really present with what's going on, and to part of what's going on is the vastness of all life, the interdependence of all life, even when our own immediate little dramas are unfolding, so that we can act in accord with the true interdependent and fleeting nature of any of our moments in our life, and use our life energy well, rather than recklessly, carelessly, ignorantly. We were talking yesterday about what motivates practice, and I guess, you know, one of the things I said is that I practice so that I don't live in a stupid way. Occasionally I actually don't live in a stupid way. I fall back into my stupid ways a lot, as probably we all do, but stupid meaning mindless, without the really wise heart mind present and available as our source, is what's stupid. And what's wise is really being awake and aware, not only of what's going on around us, but what's going on inside us, what our own mental turmoils are, what our own stories are, what our own limited views are, and all of this is what this practice can help us delve into and become much more aware of, so that we are informed in the way that we proceed. I'm not going to give a Dharma talk per se today, but I wanted to share a wonderful little story about Patrul Rinpoche, and then open the arena for questions. It's been a long time since we've just had an open Dharma discussion opportunity on a Sunday, so I thought we would do that today. So I want to read you this little tidbit. This is Patrul Rinpoche. It's just such a wonderful example of his wisdom. He was a 19th century Dzogchen master, Buddhist master in Tibet. He was just a very great and enlightened person who was not particularly interested in the monastic format. He lived as a mendicant, so he didn't have any means of support except his own wits and his influence on those he came into contact with. And so he became known as a great master and was supported in that way. He also was kind of unkempt in his personal body presentation, and he was just kind of a wild man, deeply awake to interdependence and deeply committed to the Bodhisattva way. So his major teaching during his many years of wandering was the Bodhisattva way, the Shantideva's teaching on the Bodhisattva way. So here's a little story about his wandering. He was a vagabond. This is a wonderful book called The Enlightened Vagabond. It's a memoir of him by one of his followers, Mathieu Ricard, who some of you may be familiar with. So here's a little story that I thought would be fun to share. The title of this little vignette is called Patrul and the Tossed Louse. Everybody know what a louse is? Has anybody ever encountered a louse? Yeah, it's memorable, isn't it? It usually, you know, in this culture, we can live our whole life without encountering a louse, but there are many places in the world where you can't. So once late in the afternoon, the vagabond patrol arrived at a small nomad encampment. And so that's how in the high steppes of the Himalayan range, there are many nomads. Nomad groups who are herders. He saw a young nomad girl who was milking the dzomos, which is one of the herds. They're kind of what are those? The ones that are in Peru, llamas. They're kind of like that. And he met a young nomad girl who was milking the dzomos and asked if he might take shelter there for the night. He was on his way to a local monastery to teach the way of the Bodhisattva, which is what he did. He wandered around and he taught. The girl told him she would ask her mother and went inside the tent to do so. Her mother peered out from the tent at Patrul and looked him over with suspicion, because he just looked like a kind of a suspicious fellow. She said to her daughter in a warning tone, "You know, that sort of homeless beggar could very well be carrying some awful infectious disease, or else he might be a thief." The mother hesitated, thinking it over, and then relented, saying, "Oh, all right, tell him he can stay in the tent. He can sleep way over there in the far corner." They lived in yurts, you know, huge felt tents. They gave him some tsampa with hot tea. That's a grain that barley grain that they is a mainstay of their diet there, which he was very grateful to receive. He may not have eaten for a few days. He was very grateful to receive it because it was very cold. Patrul went to the far corner of the tent as instructed. He recited his prayers and then settled down to go to sleep. The daughter noticed that for warmth, Patrul had only his clothes and no blanket or bedding. She asked her mother if they had anything to give Patrul to keep him warm. "Well, we have that old rolled up sheepskin. It's full of lice, but it's better than nothing." Oh, can you imagine it? The nomad daughter unrolled the old sheepskin and gave it to Patrul, who gratefully took it and put it over himself. Mother and daughter lay down to go to sleep on the opposite side of the tent, some yards away. As the mother was settling down to sleep, she felt a little tickle on her waist. Tossing off her bedding, she discovered a little louse crawling around at her waistline. Gently, she picked it up and gave it to her daughter, saying, "Take this louse and wrap it up in a bit of wool for the night. Tomorrow morning, take it outside and put it somewhere safe, out of the sun. Throw it someplace where it won't die." "Throw it someplace where it won't die," interjected Patrul suddenly, raising his head from under the filthy sheepskin. "If there's a place like that, would you be kind enough to throw me there too?" There's always an opportunity to reflect on our condition, huh? Some of the most unexpected situations. So it's because we all are aware, and some more than others, some more immediately than others, of the fact that we are going to die, which puts the whole question of what is this life? What is this life? Who am I? What am I here for, if it's all temporary? It comes with being a human life and being having consciousness. It's the base of all of our religious and spiritual seeking, huh? So we do that in our own way in this tradition. We have our methods. And part of it is coming together, meditating, and considering some of the questions that arise in life, in our own life, and also in the life of the teaching. So what is this teaching all about? So it's really helpful to be to ask your questions and continue to. In a certain way, the questions and asking the questions is much more important than the answers. Because we really engage with our own lives in a way, in the way of inquiry, which is really, if there's a Buddha way, it's the way of inquiry. There's a lot of teaching, there's a lot of wisdom that we access in this tradition, profound wisdom. But at the root of that is the encouragement to question, to look into, to not take for granted what are the appearances and our first impressions of things. To not take for granted that what we believe or what we think is what is actually the case, right? So I open the floor for any questions that you may have. Yeah.
Why would the mother be interested in not killing the louse? My instinct, if I saw a louse, would be to smush it or throw in the fire or something. But her instinct was to go to a special effort not to kill it.
Interesting, huh? Especially after when we first meet her, she's like, oh, that
yes.
beggar, keep him out. And then the daughter looks at her mother and says, oh, it's cold. So here's this very rough and tumble person who also is very deeply compassionate and recognizes the louse as a living being. And not just from her own standpoint. Not just this louse is an object in my life, it is annoying, so I'll get rid of it, but it has a life of its own. It also is a very culturally maintained, I don't know about now, but in traditional Tibetan culture, compassion for all beings is a central cultural value. Whether or not it was lived out, that's a different thing, because there's a lot of cruelty in that culture as well, but yeah. So does anybody ever have an experience with something that would be obnoxious, but then you stop because you realize, oh, wait a minute, there's a being that has a life that's not just about me and how I'm affected.
Catching spiders in my little bug jar, or any bugs really. Sometimes I can just pick them up and put them outside in a plant.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels like if I smush it, what if something smushed me? You know, some big thing comes down.
Godzilla.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's really becoming aware that it has. It really has a right to its little life to live it out.
It's really fun to, if you decide to take this on as a practice, if you don't have a super strong aversion. I mean, some people are just can't work with their aversion to spiders, but most people can, and they are really beneficial beings from a human standpoint, right? Because they help keep a lot in the garden in balance. But to begin to look at what we call bug, that's a word that we apply to thousands, perhaps, of species,
mm-hmm.
many of which have yet to be identified, yet to be noticed. And they go from all the way from not seeable, the no-see-ums, to those that are very small or those that are larger. And they, if you look at them closely, I mean, so many of them have faces that you recognize. I look closely at the face of a mosquito or a fly, and there's something very, very familiar. And then I look at, you know, somebody I know, and I think, you look like a mosquito. All life has faces. Some flowers have faces. Pansies have faces. I think that that's, Eric, that's one of the things that's that's one of the many details in this story that's notable, is that she says, wrap the louse in a piece of wool.
It's a great story. And I was wondering if perhaps, not knowing the woman, not knowing who this mendicant was trying to teach him a little bit by using the louse as a living being that was really just as important as him. And you know, she did finally take care of him, but she's also going to take care of this louse. And also, he's sleeping with all those lice, right? And telling him, those lice are all really important. But then it seems like he one-ups her a little bit by saying, it's all changing. It's always all changing. You know? That's just my first thing.
She certainly is teaching her daughter. So she's passing along her wisdom, and then he passes along his. And that's really what we do in Sangha. We're always, I mean, it's not that we're teaching each other because I know and you don't know, and so listen to me, I'm the authority, but we all have insights that we share into the nature of our experience. How many have had a moment where a child said something to you that was just infinitely wise and cut through all of your adult complicating mind? We all have access. This is an intrinsic wisdom that we can tap when we are not quite so noisy in our brains, in our thinking faculty. Thinking is really important. It's a tremendous gift. It's potent. And to know its function and to know its limits is a blessing. It's very useful, important. Any other comments or questions?
A comment.
Yeah.
I was kind of taken by, maybe it's a cultural difference or a time that we live in, but that the daughter would be the person to come across this mendicant, this rough-looking man, and take him to her mother seems so contrary to our lives today, where we protect our children from those kinds of encounters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Marilyn.
So the thing that kind of struck me about the story and that I really connected with when you were asking us afterwards was that sometimes it's so much easier to show that kindness to animals or bugs or the gross little things, because you can look at it and go, well, it's just being a spider, it's just being a louse, but it's hard to do that with people that you find abhorrent or annoying or just doesn't mesh with you for whatever reason. That was interesting, because that's something I personally really struggle with, is seeing other people as people when I'm butting heads with them and remembering that they deserve compassion too.
And what is compassion?
Understanding. Kindness. Refraining from judgment.
I guess. That's a really solid start here. Yeah. What is compassion? Let's bring that forward a little bit more even. Yeah.
Acknowledge. acknowledging that the other person has their own impression of the world, and it's valid, and it is, it's worth being heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, recognizing that.
Not being afraid to feel the pain of oneself or others.
Not being afraid to feel the pain of others, yeah. Because very often when somebody is in a lot of pain, you just want to, or in need. Mm-hmm. Don't want to feel it. Yeah.
Kind of related to that is connecting to the fact that you know what suffering is and not wishing that on others. Wanting that person to be free of suffering, even though it might not materialize, but it's an intention, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. You know it, and so you recognize it, and then can wish others to be free. Yeah. I saw a hand back there, yeah.
For me, I always try and put in the word unconditional when I try and think about it.
Can everybody hear?
Speak up a little bit.
Speak up.
For me, I always try to put in the word unconditional when I try and think about compassion for myself, because I think that's an important part of it. As far as showing kindness and everything, if it's conditional kindness, it's not quite the same. So it's something I try to think about, is keeping it unconditional.
So you said the part about compassion being unconditional, it's not about the conditions of somebody, the conditions that somebody presents themselves in. But you also said self. Self-compassion. And that's something that is so such a central issue in Zen practice, because of the way we do it, which is, look at all of the lines we're seated in. You know, you come in and you say, okay, when you come and you pass in front of the altar, you bow, and when you hold up the chant book, you do it this way, and we tell you how to do everything. And so that brings up for a lot of people the feeling of being a kid again and being told what to do, and that is an issue that that gets sorted out if you decide that it's worth it for you, because you get so much from it. But the spirit behind all of that is to free us from having to make choices all the time. So we learn a choreography, And then we just can do it, and we don't have to pay attention to what we're doing. And it also allows us all to move together smoothly through a practice period or whatever. But the thing that happens before all of that gets sorted out internally in relation to practice is you can get very self-critical. And one of the things that is true in so much suffering is it comes from our own self-criticism that we either directly experience or we project onto other people. Or, you know, other people do criticize us. I mean, that's a reality sometimes, but much of the time, it's our own thing that we are reading on somebody else's face. And so practice is really sorting out, learning compassion for the source of one's own criticism, and coming into relation to the things that are troubling about your own self, coming into a sympathetic witness relationship. You know, we often say that this is not a self-improvement project, meaning we don't have to make ourselves be some other way, some particular way that the Zen people know how to do it, and you're going to learn it and get it. That's not what's being put forward. We are learning how to become thoroughly ourself, and our best self in that, our most open and intelligent self, our most sensitive and responsive, our most realistic and unfettered. so that we can, you know, if I'm feeling critical of myself, I'm going to be defensive in all sorts of ways. If I am in at peace with myself, I can be at peace with anybody else. If somebody's having a hard time, I recognize it because I know it. I know that state because I allow myself to come into sympathetic witness to the whole range of my own inner experience. What do you think? Yeah.
Kind of along those same lines, I was pondering how this story shows the relationship between fear, and specifically the fear of harm to the self as this kind of obstacle that has to be confronted. And in order to find freedom and to be compassionate, because like the daughter and the insights that they're sharing with each other to kind of confront that fear, because the daughter is sort of, you know, the mother says this man could harm us, right? She's trying to protect them. And in a similar way, you know, the daughter might think that the flea was a nuisance or something that's just gonna, and that's what I would think about a bug that was in my bed probably at night. Like, oh, that's, you know, that's gonna cause me harm. So in order to, and then also the mendicant, in maybe another kind of interesting way that I don't know how to work out exactly, is helping them to confront the fear of death, maybe that they wouldn't confront otherwise, in order so that they can all find this connection and be compassionate with each other. So for me, there's a lot there about fear of, you know, self and self-protection and finding a way to come to terms with that.
Yeah. And just the centrality in all of our lives of self-protection. Of that impulse to protect, and we take for granted that there's always a reason to protect, and there is a self to protect. But that's what we call into question: is one, is there a reason to protect? Is there real separation there? And is there a self? And in what way is there a self? I mean, one of the things that's, one of the implications of the compassion teaching is that to see others as ourself, it's easy when you can really, when you really right off the bat recognize a state of mind in somebody else that you have. You can say, oh yeah, I get that. It takes kind of a vow, a practice vow, to be willing to do that when we don't identify with a certain state of mind that we're having trouble with, or we think is dangerous. Might be dangerous. I mean, that's another thing, you know, sometimes we are at risk. Our safety or the safety of others is at risk. So does that challenge this teaching? Does it challenge this teaching? Eric, you say no, so in what way does it not challenge this teaching?
It's tough to look at that. Negotiate it,
yeah.
Like, there is real risk, and also there's fear, and they're not always the same. You have to manage life with both of those things.
You have to manage life, that's right. Discern. So we talk a lot about discerning. What is, you know, in the absolute sense, absolute as opposed to relative, right? Absolute. In the absolute sense, there's no separation. This whole life comes forward together moment by moment. What I do affects you. What you do affects me. In that way, there's no separation. We're not individuals in that way. We are collectively causing and resulting together. But But at the same time, we are individuals. And it's up to each one of us to choose our actions. I can't make you feel a certain way. I can't make you act a certain way. I can't make myself act a certain way. I can choose to aspire and practice, you know. So there's separation and there's oneness. It's learning how to discern situation by situation what's going on and at what level to respond is something that takes skill. So that's one of the things that this story is about, actually. Because the knee-jerk response of the mother is, danger, keep him away. Well, then, that doesn't quite go that way, so okay, he can sleep over there. And then the louse comes up. So we're constantly shifting our view of what is the real situation at what level, you know? In what view are we going to hold about a louse? What view are we going to hold about a beggar? What are we going to... What about hospitality? Hospitality in a really rough environmental situation has different rules than when everybody is well-fed and clothed and everything else. What about the value of hospitality? So discerning the different what we are called to respond to in every situation.
The choice is, do we live within the confines of fear, which is something we have, or do we live fully? If we live in the confines of fear, we won't do anything.
Right.
We'll just sit in our house and put bars on the doors and buy more guns.
That's one solution.
Yeah,
that's being thoroughly investigated.
Yeah, very well accepted solution in
yeah.
parts of the world.
Yeah.
But do we live within that?
Thank you for bringing that up, because I often think of two things that go together. They're not opposites, but they go together. Fear or faith? Am I going to live, is my life going to be based in fear or in faith? And faith in Buddhism is not defined in the same way as it's defined in various other religious groups. Faith is faith in my life. Faith in my life to be adequate, to be enough, to be complete. Faith in my ability to be open-hearted. Faith, you know, so faith comes out of, it's not blind faith. It comes out of experience, faith in experience. I mean, what we're always referring back to is, what is our direct experience? Everybody here, I assume, has had some really hard things go on in your life, right?
Yeah.
Really difficult, maybe even life-threatening, and yet, here we are. So that experience shoots us out to this moment, which is blessed and complete. They always are, even the most difficult are complete. Each moment is complete. Having faith in that, having faith that everything is all right. That's one of the phrases. Everything is all right, just the way it is. That's a statement of faith. That's not a conventional. I mean, our conventional mind wouldn't say, "Well, no, I don't think everything's all right just as it is." There's incredible cruelty and destruction going on in the world. That's not all right. So at what level do we look at that everything is all right? And that's talking about the completeness in our own experience as practitioners of the way. So it's really potent help at a hard time to say, in what way is this all right? In what way is this a blessing? You know, what is actually missing? So all of that is swept into this faith mind. There are teachings on the faith mind having to do with everything being complete, sufficient. Yet we live in a cultural context where we are constantly hearing the message and giving the message that we need something else. Something's missing. Something's missing in me. Something's missing in my activities or my status or my... Something's missing. Something's missing in this relationship. I have to look for the right relationship. Something's missing in my body. So how are we doing? One more?
It's 11:35.
Okay, one more comment, and then we can... Yeah.
So I really like him, this guy. We didn't talk about him very much, but how do you tell when somebody is really a master? One way you tell is that they don't take themselves seriously. They are willing to be lighthearted. And when he pops out of the blanket and he says, hey, put me where I won't die, he's kidding around, but he's also showing you that he knows about life and death. He knows about the great matter, but he's doing it in a lighthearted way. And the one way you know a great master is that.
He is very, very playful.
Yeah.
Very playful. Yeah. So, you know, what we can all look at. So what keeps me from being playful? You know, it's worry. Fear. Feeling of limit. That it might not go over okay, you know. Anyway, so thanks for listening and for participating. And let's go on now to our closing